بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat. The ruling that we'd like to mention, there's a couple of them. One I will explain a bit more openly and clearly. The other one I will allude to, and brothers and sisters can follow up with it. The first is about, well, it's not the best thing to speak about, but it's one of those things that invalidates the fast, and it needs to be mentioned and clarified. I've seen misunderstandings related to this, and that is vomiting. Okay. If a person intentionally causes themselves to vomit by, for example, sticking their finger down their throat, okay, and they cause themselves to vomit, that is going to invalidate the fast. That's exactly what we mean, and the only thing we mean by causing oneself to vomit. If somebody has, God forbid, I don't know why in the world why somebody would want to do this, but if someone does this, that they have food or they have something that they eat before they start their fast that will cause them to vomit during the day, that will not invalidate the fast. What will invalidate the fast is simply causing one by, as I said, touching the back of their throat to cause themselves to vomit. That will invalidate the fast. But if one has nothing to do with it, one gets sick or there's a virus or something that causes this to happen, that's not going to invalidate the fast itself. All right. As I said, even if one causes it by intentionally taking something, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's some medication that someone needs to take that will cause them in a few hours to vomit. If they do that, that's not going to invalidate the fast. However, if it so happens that one vomits during fast, they have to control and not allow it to go back. Now, usually and obviously, if somebody vomits, they would not like to take that and swallow it back in. But sometimes what comes out is just a small amount, okay? And one may forget and they may swallow it, which if actually do that, because they have forgotten, they didn't intentionally swallow, that will not break their fast. But they need to be conscious, we need to be careful, so we don't swallow anything other than the normal saliva that's in our mouth. That's one ruling that we have related to fast. The second ruling is that, well, there are a number of them that I'd like to allude to, as I said. One thing I'd like to say first before I mention this, although I won't get into the details of it, but when we want to mention ahkam, brothers and sisters, we have a bit of a dilemma. Okay. Because certain people think and feel that the pulpit and the minbar is not the place to speak of certain things. Okay. This is a problem. This is a problem. It is cultural, and it's not based on the Quran, it's not based on hadith, it's not based on the doing of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. In some sessions I've said, if I were to simply translate some of the verses of the Holy Quran, some of you would get up and pull me off the pulpit. Okay. If I would simply translate the literal meaning of the words of some of the verses of the Holy Quran. We have to learn what is right and what is wrong from the Quran, from hadith, from the Ahlul Bayt. If I were to tell you some of the ahadith we have the Holy Prophet, Some of the ways that he interacted with people, you wouldn't believe your ears. Okay. Now with that, again, I'm not going to get into the details, but I do need to make this, or at least allude to it. In the month of Ramadan, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to avoid, during the day, what's related to the material side of us, what we have and we share with animals. One of them is eating and drinking, but the other is sexual activity. Okay, sexual activity with details in certain cases invalidates the fast. All right, and in some cases, if we do not make ourselves tahir before Fajr time, then again that day's fast is going to be lost. I feel that it's necessary to at least hear that much so that people can go follow up with the details, look into the risalas, especially the younger ones, so they can learn their masail, inshallah. Recite a salawat. Over the course of these nights, we've been talking about the Ahlul Bayt, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in, in hope of, and with the intention that through speaking of them, hearing of them, thinking of them, remembering them, in this blessed month, we're able to move closer to the ideals that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has for us, to move towards His proximity as the remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt as ibadah and worship. But also, the reason why we're mentioning this is because there are many important lessons that need to be learned from the Ahlul Bayt. A lot of them we are not familiar with or less familiar with. We spoke of the Holy Prophet, we spoke of Amir al-Mu'mineen, we spoke of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, we spoke of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, and last night we spoke of and about Imam al-Husayn, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. Tonight we want to speak again briefly. Every night we speak only of one of the ma'sumin, and giving only one night, 45 minutes to a ma'sum is really injustice to the ma'sum and trying to understand them. But some of us haven't even heard that much of some of the ma'sumin. But very briefly, we want to go through some of what we can learn from this beloved Imam of ours, Imam Zainul Abidin, Sayyidu Sajidin. That we have much to learn from and very little that we know. Some of us, if anything, may know of Sahifa As-Sajadiyya. As-Sahifa As-Sajadiyya, the book of du'as that we have. That is something that Imam Zainul Abidin has left behind for us. If we know anything, maybe that's it. And of course, and obviously, the story of Karbala and Imam Zainul Abidin in Karbala and Sham. But what happens after that until the year 95, the year of the Shahada of Imam Zainul Abidin, from the year 61 to the year 95, 34 years of imamah. The only thing we know of this is maybe some du'as, maybe a month or two after the incident in Karbala. That's all we know of Imam Zainul Abidin. Maybe we've heard about his ibadat in the context of being explained the meaning of the word Zainul Abidin, why they called him Zainul Abidin, or why they called him Sayyidu Sajidin, or why he's referred to as Sajjad. And this is unacceptable. As I have done in the previous nights as well, I would like to encourage all brothers and sisters, every single one of us, to take it upon ourselves to go and learn about the Ahlul Bayt. Let's not simply wait for someone to come and provide us with that information. We have got to be proactive. We've got to take action ourselves. We got to learn of the books that are available. And I've said this to people as well, if there aren't books available in English, That doesn't mean we still don't have a responsibility. We got to do something to get books in English. If others aren't doing it, we got to do something about it. Now, what can we say about Imam Zainul Abidin? There's a couple of things that we know Imam Zainul Abidin of, and because of that, I'll tell you what usually I feel most of us probably, or actually definitely, including myself, before I studied the life of Imam Zainul Abidin, think of this Imam. What we think of the Imam is a man who, after Karbala, was taken around, he was ill, he was all chained up. He couldn't even lead that group of people that he had with him. The lady Zainab salamullah alayha had to do that. And in some instances, he said just a few words that we can only cry about. And when they went to Medina, the Imam was just in Medina doing nothing except for dua and prayer. And then when they, at some points, he would remember Karbala, the atrocities in Karbala, and shed tears. A person, a man, who comes back from war and does nothing but sit at home and pray. That, I think, summarizes, unfortunately, the understanding we have of Imam Zainul Abidin. Am I wrong? Does anybody think, do any of you, any of us have a different impression of the Imam? Have we heard of anything other than that? To me, I'm wondering, I'm supposed to take pride in having Imam Zainul Abidin as an Imam of mine. What is it in this characteristic or in this personality that I just described that is worthy of praise? Of course, if one looks at the du'as of Imam Zainul Abidin from the perspective of the irfan that's within them, the spirituality, what he teaches in them, that itself is very high. But if that's simply what the Imam has done, with all that happened during those years of the government of Yazid, then after the son of Yazid, Muawiyah, and others until there was Abdul Malik ibn Marwan that became the Khalifa. All of what was going on, Imam al-Husayn salamullah alayh went to Karbala, lost his life, had his Ali al-Akbar qatta'uhu irban irba. They cut him into pieces. And Imam Zainul Abidin is there, Abdul Malik ibn Marwan, this ruthless ruler is there, and Imam Zainul Abidin is simply dua. Do you see a contradiction between these two Imams? They're very ruthless. If Yazid was openly committing sin, you think Abdul Malik ibn Marwan was not openly committing sin? He was not openly drinking, openly calling for dancers and singers to come and set up sessions. Not only did he do that, but in Mecca and Medina of the Holy Prophet, they had singers that were considered the stars, the role models, people that when they would die, everybody would be in tears. Singers. Female singers would be singing in Mecca and Medina. Imam Zainul Abidin salamullah alayhi. Simply dua, I have nothing to do with anything. I think we need to revisit history, look at it, and try to learn and understand it a bit differently. Understanding first, based on the most reliable of our sources, who the Imams were, then look back at history and try to see if we can identify what they actually did. Because we have to know that history does not record every little detail. History The way it's recorded also, it's scattered. You'll find one piece of evidence here, another piece of evidence there. You're not going to find it all in our hadith books, for example. How are you going to put these bits and pieces of information and analyze who the imams actually were? God forbid, if we don't do this, you know what's going to happen? If you go to the historic sources, God forbid, al-ayadu billah, one can come and understand even the Holy Prophet the way Salman Rushdie did. If you go to the Muslim historians, you can even picture the Holy Prophet, al-ayadu billah, God forbid. You get confused. We have to revisit and thoroughly understand the imams. The first thing I would like to speak of, because this is, I think, fundamental with regards to this imam and the imams after him, the fifth imam and onwards as well, that will help us have an understanding that is different than what we've got up to this point. And that is understanding the term imam. What does an imam mean? What is the concept of imam? Very briefly, I would like to mention to you. First, I will tell you what we have today. What our understanding usually is. 99.9% of us understand imam as being this. What is imam in our understanding? Imam means someone who has a very strong spiritual relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we get our religion from. That's what imam means. Isn't it the case? Is there anything else that you understand from the concept of imamah? This is what we understand. Today, I'll give you some examples so we can maybe make sure that this is the understanding that we have, all right? I am sure that this is the understanding that the majority of Shia have. Who is your imam today? Who's your imam? The 12th imam, right? Imam al-Zaman. Ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu al-sharif. What does this imam mean for you? What does it exactly mean that he is currently your imam? Does anybody here not accept that he's your imam? If he is your imam, what does that mean in your life? I think the only thing that it means is that his fathers gave you the religion and then you go do taqlid and learn based on the ahadith how to pray, how to fast. That's pretty much it. There's nothing else between you and the imam of our time, is there? The meaning of imam in books of theology is proving this. Proving that after the Holy Prophet, we needed to have people that were ma'soom, that are infallible, because otherwise the religion of Allah would have been changed. Okay. Those are the proofs. So we need someone that knows the religion and can explain religion. This is what we have in our books of aqa'id. And this is what we currently understand of imamah. All the talk we have with others that don't believe in imamah is to prove, for example, that the imams were appointed by God. Imams were ma'soom, they were infallible. And that we need to get our religion from them. That's pretty much it. Yes, and we also have a historical discussion and debate whether Amir al-Mu'mineen was supposed to rule after the Holy Prophet or not. That's pretty much it. That's as political as it gets. That's it. However, when we look at the term imamah, in the history of Islam, whether it's the Qur'an itself, or the ahadith, history, the discussions, debates amongst Muslimin, not amongst Shia, amongst Muslimin with regards to the term imama, you see that it's drastically different. In the Quran, an imam is someone who leads people in all arenas of life. An imam doesn't simply provide instructions. That will be a rasul, someone who explains. If someone just gives you lectures and tells you, look, this is what God has said to you, that's not an imam. That's not a Quranic concept. An imam is supposed to give you that guidance for you as an individual, give you the guidance for you as families, and provide the guidance for people in society. Authority in society. The authority that's supposed to govern the lives of people on earth is an imam. This is what we have in the Holy Quran. The prophets that were also imams, like Prophet Musa, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam. He led the people against the tyrant of the time, Fir'aun. How many times did the Quran talk about this? Then he went and established government. His successors were prophets that were rulers. These are imams. In the Holy Quran, the meaning of the word imam is this. When the Holy Prophet talks about imamah, that Amir al-Mu'mineen is the imam after the Holy Prophet, it means the one that leads people in every area of life, including their political affairs, including government. Authority in the Muslim nation has got to be in the hands of the imam. Right? The dispute between Shia and Sunni from the time of the demise of the Holy Prophet until when theological schools of thought started to form during the time of Imam As-Sadiq salamullah alayhi. We're talking about imam. They use the term imam to refer to the political leader. Everybody understood that the Khalifa of the time would be considered the imam. They referred to these individuals as the imam. The theological discussions that formed were this. What are the qualifications that an imam needs to have? What do they mean by an imam? The political leader. So the Quran talks about imamah as something that's comprehensive. It's the authority that a person has, an imam has, over spiritual affairs as well, religious affairs as well, and worldly affairs and government, the whole package. But what happened after the Holy Prophet was keep the political leadership, get rid of what? The spiritual religious. The political leader is simply a political leader. Imam is someone that can manage society, someone that can rule over people. Anyone that can rule over people is going to be an imam. They debated, does this imam have to be someone that knows religion? Does he not have to be someone that knows religion? Does he have to be someone that is practicing religion? Or does he not have to be someone that that is practicing religion? And some explicitly said, no, none of that's necessary. So the term imam, during the time of Imam As-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi, turned into only a political understanding of the word, and it had political connotations to it. And of course, the imams would insist that that political leader should be the religious leader as well, should have the spiritual qualifications as well, needs to have that personal justice as well. So Ahlul Sunnah at that time were saying, Imam doesn't need to have religious authority, doesn't need to have spiritual authority. They don't need to be someone that is a scholar, someone that is knowledgeable. The Imams were saying, no, it needs to be someone that is knowledgeable, has the highest knowledge at the time. That was the debate then. So the word Imam, if you follow the history of it, whether it was in the Quran, the time of the Ahlul Bayt, it always had the meaning of government in it. It's interesting, let me say this from a historic perspective. Sometimes people think that imamah is something that we have as Shia. That's not correct. Sunnis also had imamah. They may not use the same word sometimes today. And of course they do. They do even more than we do. Someone who leads a masjid is what? An imam. We don't refer to Maulana is Imam. We don't call them that, although it's become common. Some Shia masjids are calling their Maulanas Imams. But that's not common amongst us here. But Ahlul Sunnah, they have the concept of Imamah. What is meant by Imamah? What was meant? They can't say that here, of course. What was meant by Imamah was political leadership. In the Qur'an, during the time of the Ahlul Bayt, the political part of that leadership was always known and understood. What was questioned and doubted by some was religious leadership. That political leader needs to be the religious leader as well. That the Ahlul Bayt insisted, yes, it needs to be the combination, the whole package. But later on, due to many different events and incidents in history, what we have right now in the concept of imamah is almost completely apolitical. It's non-political. It has nothing to do with politics. Therefore, when we hear that Imam Zain al-Abidin simply was involved with dua, it doesn't hit us. We're like, okay, that's what the imam was like. But if you think that Imam Zain al-Abidin is an imam, is the one that leading people politically, socially, spiritually, religiously, all of it, he has that responsibility, then when you look at that, you think there's something wrong with that picture. The imams were imams. From that perspective, every single one of them, even the imams that you've never heard them having any type of political activity, any type of involvement. This is important for us to make note of. With this understanding of what imam means, when God says he is the imam, that means that he has the responsibility of leading people in all arenas of life. So what did the Imam do? What did Imam Zain al-Abidin do? During his lifespan as an Imam for the 34 years, what did Imam Zain al-Abidin salamullah alayhi do? The Imam of the Imam begins in very harsh circumstances. On the plains of Karbala, when the skies wept blood, the imamah of Imam Zain al-Abidin begins. The responsibility to lead the ummah, taking on that responsibility from where Imam al-Husayn and that blessed part of the world that was colored red with the blood of the Imam, where Imam al-Husayn left off, now Imam Zain al-Abidin is starting to move this forward. Okay. What did Imam Zain al-Abidin do? There are many things that can be said as the different activities of the Imam. If you want to look at the scattered bits and pieces of information we have of what the Imam has done, we can probably go on for days talking about those, but we won't be able to understand what the strategy of the Imam was. You have certain things that you do maybe now and then as secondary things in your life, but the strategy, the goals that you have, the long-term planning you have, which the Ahlul Bayt, as I mentioned with regards to Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba salamullahi, all of them are great planners, okay? Strategists, the best of them. No one can compare to them. I don't know why we don't understand them as that. They were the best political analysts of their time. No one could do anything better than them. And the strategies they had were the best, most effective. If we look at the scattered bits and pieces of information, for example, talking about a small talk that Imam Zain al-Abidin had in the court of Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad, in the court of Yazid later on in Sham, we can talk about that, that's important, and it's good, but we won't be able to get the strategy of the Imam. That I would like to, if we had the time, to talk about that part of the history of Imam Zain al-Abidin in the context of the movement of Karbala. He's finishing off what Imam al-Husayn has done. If Imam Zain al-Abidin hadn't taken the stances and guided the women and children the way he did during that trip from Karbala to Kufa to Sham, the movement of Imam al-Husayn would not have had the impact that it did. Okay. But that's a package that comes and we need to discuss in the story of Karbala. All right. The strategy of the Imam after Karbala. What is the strategy of the Imam? First, in order to understand that, we need to briefly talk about the context in which the Imam lived. The context that which in which the Imam lived. We briefly talked about that in the context of the previous Imams. Why Imam al-Husayn, last night we were talking about why Imam al-Husayn had to take this stance. In that we explained a bit the context. We said that the companions of the Holy Prophet, the people that were supposed to be those who lead others in the society they live in, the ones that make conscious decisions, they know Islam, they have an understanding of it, they've had a relationship with the Holy Prophet, or with Amirul Mu'mineen, or with Imam al-Hasan or Imam al-Husayn, or with companions of the Holy Prophet, even if they were not the Imams. These people had knowledge of the deen, but what had happened was that their taste buds had changed. At the time of the Prophet, what was important was the hereafter. What was important was Allah. What was important was not the dunya, not the glamour of the dunya, but God being pleased with one. Giving up the material life was easy. People would cry to have that. They would weep if they didn't have the opportunity to go to battle and put their lives on the line. They would pray and beg the Holy Prophet to pray for them as well, so that they can reach the rank of shahada. They were longing for the moment of death. This is at the time of the Prophet. Gradually that changed. The race now was who's got more money, who's got more gold, who's got more silver, who's got more land, who's got more positions, authority, power, fame. These became important to people. What happened? Amirul Mu'mineen, Imam Hassan and Imam al-Husayn, salamullah alayhim ajma'een. We're trying to create the Islamic system of government the way the Holy Prophet wanted it to be, using those companions of the Holy Prophet or the companions of the Holy Prophet that were already there, that had already felt what Islam was all about. They had felt that spiritual connection with God. They had felt what it means to be detached of the world. They had already received that training. There weren't too many, but they were enough to lead others and fix everything up. In other words, with the people that were already there, The Imams wanted to fix the society of the Holy Prophet, the nation of the Holy Prophet, using the individuals that were already there and influence everybody else from top to bottom. In other words, there's a lot of people that don't have information of religion or proper information of religion. How do you change that? Government. Look, government is extremely important. I got to say this for just a couple of minutes. This is why the responsibility of the Imam is this. The ruling class is going to control the spiritual lives of people as well. The ruling class will have control over that. I was just reading today. I don't know if you've read or not. In northwest China, there's a pretty large Muslim population. 45% of that region is Muslim. The Chinese government has banned them from fasting in the month of Ramadan, joining programs of faith, joining prayers. It's a crime. What do you have to do with people's religion? I thought it's secular. Yeah, you can. In other regions in China, there are Muslims. In Beijing, there's Muslims that live. They're not banned because they're okay. They don't pose a threat to the authority of the government there. But when you have a 45% population and they're increasing, the government feels, oh, wait a second, you know, this can't go on. That's a threat. They will influence the religion of the people. We talked about examples last night. They will fabricate hadith to make Muawiyah look like a great person and Amir al-Mu'mineen look like a sinner. Al-Ayadu Billah. They will have it part of the Jum'ah khutbahs and part of every lecture. You know, we start the lecture with salawat upon the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. Okay? They would start their khutbahs and they would make sure everyone who speaks publicly starts their khutbah with cursing Amir al-Mu'mineen. It's their political agenda. If they don't do that, the followers of Amir al-Mu'mineen that are following Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, that later follow Imam al-Husayn, are going to increase. The masses will know how great people they were, and they would follow them. That's a threat. That's a political threat. They're not going to have that. They will interfere with religion. The same way that it can be negative, it can also be positive. If you want the masses to reach prosperity, Islamic government is what's going to guarantee that. Without Islamic government, there might be some people that will be strong enough to move forward, not commit sins, progress spiritually. But many people will fail to reach the greatest spiritual levels that they could have reached because there's just too much sin around. There's just too much sin around. And the ruling class is not going to get rid of it. That's how they get richer and richer and richer. That's how they can rule. They're going to have that up over there. Islamic government. So the Imams were trying to use what was available, the manpower that was available from the time of the Holy Prophet, to create that government. What happened was that with Karbala and a couple of other incidents after it, like Waq'atul Harra in the year 63 after the Hijrah, the companions of the Holy Prophet, those who remained, some of the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, some of those who were considered Shia, at least to a certain extent, some of those who were not necessarily considered Shia, but they were still good people, good followers of the Ahlul Bayt that didn't like the corruption, they were taken to Sham, to Damascus. They saw Yazid, how terrible a person he was. They came back to Medina. They started telling people, look, this guy is a serious sinner. You can't have him as a Khalifa. What Imam al-Husayn said 3 years before that, they realized now. There was an uprising in Medina. Yazid sent Muslim ibn Uqba from Palestine, the ruler of Palestine. He's not Palestinian, by the way. He is from Bani Umayyah. He's from Hijaz. But he's the governor of Palestine of that time. He brings him and he sends him with troops. They attack Medina. He says, if you're victorious over these people for 3 days, the lives and the women of this city and the wealth and the belongings of the people are yours. Do whatever you wish with them. They crushed that uprising. Many people were killed. Great people were killed. Okay. So you had one killing in Karbala. You had Waq'atul Harra. You had the movement of the Tawabin led by Sulaiman ibn Surad al-Khuza'i from Kufa. 10 or 12,000 people went with him. Many of them got killed. They were slaughtered. They felt that they had committed a sin. They realized, I should say. They had sinned for not supporting Imam al-Husayn. They wanted to repent. And they went and fought an army led by Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad. They all got killed, or many of them. The leaders especially. These were the top Shias of Amir al-Mu'mineen in Kufa. They got killed. The movement of Mukhtar, that got crushed eventually. The most influential figures that remained from that time were all gone by the end of it. Imam Zainul Abidin, Salamullah alayhi, has got to... has to see and figure out what his strategy is going to be. Remember, he's got a responsibility. He's got to move that. He can't, logically and rationally, we know he can't, and we know he would never leave this people and say, okay, you did all of that, so I don't care about you guys anymore. I'm not going to fulfill that responsibility. You know, some people are like that. It's sometimes funny. I don't know if we have Iranians in the crowd or how many we have. Sometimes I've seen, I couldn't believe it when I heard it first, but... when I came across people like that, you're shocked. Guys, like, I won't pray. Why? Because this political leader in an Islamic country did something wrong. The other political figure did something wrong. The other political leader did something wrong in the Muslim country. Whether it's the president or some other figure, they did something wrong, I'm not going to pray. What does that have to do with anything? People did very wrong. I have a responsibility here. The Imam is the Imam. He's supposed to lead. What's his strategy going to be? One thing is that he can't use those individuals that already know Islamic teachings. They've spent time with the Holy Prophet or spent a lot of time with the companions of the Holy Prophet, gone through training. He can't use them because they're gone. He's got to change the strategy. There's another element that is important in understanding the circumstances before we can fully come up with what Imam Zainul Abidin decided to do. That is, well, actually two things, let me put it that way. One, fear, the fear factor. Not for the Imam, but for people that would want to follow him. If you just picture this, okay, I don't know if we're getting the vibe right now. I'll give an example of what we have today, and maybe this will help us understand it. How do you feel when you get the news of what's happening in Iraq? When you look at the brutality, the way they do things, or what you saw in Syria, they intentionally put those images online. You think they just, some stupid guy over there cutting the guy open, taking out their organs and biting it in front of the camera. Out of stupidity? No, it's not out of stupidity. Maybe that guy's stupid, yeah, but the people who are behind it aren't stupid. They want to create fear. They want to create fear. If you are here and you see that, you're shivering. You could imagine if you would be living in Syria, you would think twice about supporting the government of Syria. Because you know, if anybody knows about this, if that group walks into your town, you're dead. They will give that sword. I don't know if you've seen the images. It's terrible. They will give the sword to a child, force the child to chop the guy's head off. Inhuman. Are they stupid in doing that? Yeah, the people who are carrying it out are. But the people who are behind it, they have a plan. They want to create that fear so no one dares. They want to scare people away. In Iraq, that's why they're doing what they're doing. They pull the strings. They want people to feel that, oh, we're going to lose this. Oh my God, let me think. How can I get out of here? Recently, they had that Sayyid, he claimed Marja'iyyah, As-Sarkhi. He called himself Sayyid Mahmud Ayatullah, Sayyid Mahmud As-Sarkhi, who apparently was not an Ayatullah, was not even Sayyid. His tribe made a statement, he was Shaykh, if anything. In Karbala, this Shia supposedly, see they pull all the strings, this supposedly Shia scholar suddenly tells his followers to pull out guns and start attacking who? The Iraqi government, the Iraqi forces, the Iraqi military that is helping the people against these savage people that call themselves Daesh. Now you, the Shia, you want to attack this army? Now? Led by a government that is headed by a Shia prime minister? If you would be there, you start freaking out. Fear. Fear. So you don't want to join. To a lesser extent, to understand, to a lesser extent here, one of the tactics that was used after 9/11 was that they didn't do much. They just came to people's doors and wanted to have appointments. FBI, can I have a word with you? Can I come in? Do you know this person? Do you know that person? Fear. At that time, with these incidents, no one could believe the grandson of the Holy Prophet would be slaughtered. Great companions in Medina slaughtered and massacred. Large numbers of people, the Tawabin movement, slaughtered and massacred. Anyone that was involved with the Shia movement, the Imam's political movement, was crushed like that. Fear. So that's the second element. The first one was that the companions of the Holy Prophet, the believers that had already been trained in that school of thought, were mostly gone. Second element was fear. Third, corruption. Corruption. It is amazing what you read in history of the corruption that happened. I think mentioned already at the beginning of the talk that if you have the wrong government, those examples were for this time. You had, today we would refer to them as concerts. They would have concerts in Mecca and Medina. Mecca and Medina had the best singers, according to an account. When the Khalifa in Damascus would want the best singers, he would have his people go and bring them from Mecca and Medina, not from Damascus. People would pray for singers when they were alive. There's an incident where this young lady in Mecca, when one of the singers dies, she's in tears and she's crying. And other people around her ask her why she's crying. And she explains it's because this guy died and now we don't have anybody. And then when they tell her that no, we do have some other people, and then they recite some of the poetry of the guy who's alive, you know what she does? She doesn't say, okay, great, now let's go back to the concert or whatever. She says, Alhamdulillah, that God gave us someone. See how religion gets twisted? Corruption. Okay. What we said last night about the companions of the Holy Prophet moving away from the divine motivations, being driven by the akhirah, by the hereafter, in the masses is 10 times worse. People are not aware of their religion, they have some very terribly wrong understandings of their religion. In this context, what is Imam Zain al-Abidin going to do? What he does, according to hadith, this is not being made up, according to hadith, Imam Zain al-Abidin started a more long-term plan. That political leadership, he has it, it's a bit long-term. We don't have the people, we got to start creating the people. We need to start training the people, and that's what Imam Zain al-Abidin starts to do. Training the people that not in Imam Zain al-Abidin's lifespan, but about 70 years later, during the time of Imam Sadiq salamullah alayhi, it will bear its fruits. Imam Zain al-Abidin acted with utmost cleverness, wisdom, knowledge, bravery, and strength. When you want to plan for something that's 70 years down the line, do you even understand what 70 years down the line means? Sometimes people say, oh, the Jews have really nice planning, and you know, it's 100 years from now. The Ahlul Bayt had better planning. Okay, the Ahlul Bayt had better planning. We got to follow the Ahlul Bayt. Where is that planning? We got to figure it out. What is our strategy? The Imam had to take into consideration all three factors. The first factor we mentioned is we don't have people. The Imam is going to create those people, start training the people. People like Abu Hamza al-Thumali. Have you read these nights? You have the dua, dua of Abi Hamza al-Thumali. Have you read the dua? It's one of the longest duas that we have. Such a spiritual dua. This is one of the students of Imam Zain al-Abidin. He trains him, along with others. The other thing, the other factor is fear, remember? The factor of fear was something that the Imam had to take into consideration. That's why Imam was implementing taqiyya. Sometimes our understanding of taqiyya is very wrong. What do we think of taqiyya? Pray like this. This is taqiyya. What's taqiyya? Don't put turba. That's taqiyya. What's taqiyya? Don't talk about certain figures in history. Don't talk about that stuff. That's taqiyya. That's not taqiyya. Who says that's taqiyya? Those at some point in time, those were ways that people would do taqiyya. That's not the meaning of taqiyya. Taqiyya is this, it means fear in an environment where for your political movement, the political movement of the Ahlul Bayt, obviously they are the opposition to the Khilafah of the time. You can't be open about that, can you? They implemented taqiyya. That's why it's difficult to see this movement of Imam Zain al-Abidin. Was the practice taqiyya, but it's there. You can still see it. All right. So taqiyya is an important element in the life of Imam Zain al-Abidin, serious taqiyya. But at the same time, this doesn't mean he doesn't take any strong stances against the government. He does, you've seen it, against Yazid, and in the presence of Yazid, in the presence of Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad, in the presence of other people in Medina, elsewhere. But about the movement They had to be in utmost secrecy. Taqiyya. With regards to the corruption that existed, the imam, the corruption, what does it have to do with? It has to do with those people that he wants to train. If those previous people are gone, and the people today, they're lacking knowledge of the deen, and they are corrupt, the imam has to deal with that. How does he deal with it? Believe me, I like to cut it short, but I can't cut it any shorter than this. Okay, I'm trying to do it ASAP. I would like to finish it at 10:30, all right, and get it over with. But there's just too much stuff to mention to make it make sense, okay? Recite another salawat, please. The imam does a couple of things in order to create the individuals, the human beings, the people, the believers that have to be the means that will establish the government. Because you need people. Again, that itself needs 5-10 minutes at least explanation. I'm not going to give you that. Maybe some other night. It needs people. Okay. So in training the people, what does he do? Taking into consideration all those factors. He teaches people the fundamentals of religion. The most important ones. If you look at the teachings of Imam Zain al-Abidin, you don't see too many ahkam. You do see ahkam, right? But you don't see too many of them. What do you see? Spirituality. What do you see? Tawheed. What do you see? Relationship with Allah. What do you see? Zuhd. The insignificance of the dunya, how it's completely unimportant, worthless. These are what you see in the words of Imam Zain al-Abidi. The pillars of our belief. How what's more important is not the material, it's the non-material. You should be driven by the non-material, by godly reasons. You shouldn't be attracted and attached to the dunya. You should understand who God is, tawheed, through the du'as. Read the du'as of Sahifa Sajjadiyya. Don't be like me, please read the du'as. They contain so much information that you cannot find anywhere else about God Himself, about our relationship with God, about His relationship with us. This is one thing He does. Another thing is over the course of these years, as I think I alluded to prior to this at the beginning of my talk, they change the meaning of who an imam is. So the imams had to tell people, no, that's not an imam in the Islamic teachings. The imam in the Islamic teachings is a righteous person, is one who has knowledge of the religion, is pious, is the one who doesn't want that position for his pocket, for his desires, for his temptations. The teachings of Islam, who is the imam? It comes from the progeny of the Holy Prophet. So he had to train people on who the imam is. Who is the political leader? Understand the word imam in that context. The political leader, who is he supposed to be? The imam had to clarify that. Last but not least, and this is what makes it look more than the first two. The second point was already political enough. Talking about who the ruler should be. The guy who's ruling doesn't deserve to be the ruler. That's very political, right? Who deserves to be the ruler? Imam Zain al-Abidin does. That's a threat, you know. But more than that, the imam didn't just give that these two bits of information to people as individuals. You know what the imam did? The imam created bonds between people and created a Shia network. Okay. He created a Shia network. He laid the foundations and started it up. Imam al-Baqir salamullah alayhi carried that on and moved it forward. Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi was supposed to pick the fruit off of that. Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. Allahumma salam. which we'll explain about those imams, inshallah, in the following nights. This is what Imam Zain al-Abidin did. He's not someone that is sad because of Karbala, sitting in his home, just doing dua. That was part of his tactics. That's the taqiyya. Having the government think that, yeah, he's not involved with anything. Just involved with dua, talks about zuhd. I don't have time to go over some of those teachings, the way he taught and created this network, how he trained them, what was the general message that was going out to sort of bring people in and add them to the mass, and what was it that he would give to those who are already bought onto the idea, those that have already bought onto the idea, the ones that have become true believers, the ones that have become the real Shias, that are on the course that the Ahlul Bayt want them to be. Very cleverly, very cleverly. And we owe so much, brothers and sisters, to this Imam that unfortunately we don't know of, we don't take benefit of. Even the du'as that we mentioned are there, we don't make use of, take benefit. We hope that we're able to do that, inshallah. As-salamu alaykum. يا أهل بيت النبوة وما وضع الرسالة ومختلف الملائكة وما اهبط الوحي وما عدنا الرحمن ومنتهى الحلم. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. It was in your homes that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us with guidance and revelation. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. Angels descend upon you day in and day out. Let's take our hearts again to the lonely graves of Medina, to the graves that have no visitors on these nights. We're approaching the night of the birth of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba. Usually at these times the Shia would go to the shrines of the Ahlul Bayt, but they're not even allowed to go visit, put their hands on the soil, on the graves of the Ahlul Bayt. If you've gone for Hajj, when we went with a few brothers, when they opened the gates to go visit Baqi', we went up there. Even when we wanted to perform and recite the ziyarah, we had to whisper, Ruhi lakum ul-fida. صلى صلى الله عليك يا أبا الحسن يا علي بن الحسين يا زين العابدين. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Imam as-Sajjad. Ruhi laka al-fida. Brothers and sisters, your Imam in the later days of the month of Muharram was poisoned. But brothers and sisters, I feel that the moment he was poisoned and he was leaving this world were the moments of joy and happiness for him. You know, when the pain of Imam Zainul Abidin was, I'm not sure if his pain was when they had the chains around his neck and legs and feet and hands. The companion says in Sham, the Imam was asked, what can I do to help you? The Imam said, if you can move this chain a bit, in the heat of the summer, long hours under the sun, the metal chains, what would they do to the neck and hands of the Imam? I don't know if the moment that he saw the children being beaten on, maybe that's the time that was very painful for him. Maybe the time that he would saw his aunt Zainab being beaten on. Maybe the time that they brought and he saw a plate covered, and when unveiled, the head of his beloved father was before him. The mal'oon, using the stick on the lips of the beloved Imam al-Hussein. But brothers and sisters, I feel the most painful moment of his life was in Karbala, when he heard his father call, Hal min nasirin yansuruni, هل من ذاب يذب عن حرم رسول الله. Is there anyone to help me? Imam Zainul Abidin, hearing this, he tried with all his illness. He put all the strength he had to try to stand. How did the Imam feel when he saw he cannot help his father, Imam al-Hussein? Ala la'natullah ala al-qawm al-zalimeen, wa say'alamu al-lazina zalamu ayyamun qalabin yanqalimu. Allahumma inna nas'aluka wa nad'uuka بسمك العظيم الأعظم بالزهراء وأبيها وبعلها وبنيها والسر المستودع فيها بك يا الله 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 يا رحمن يا رحيم يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلوبنا على دينك على محبة أوليائك والله hasten the return of our Imam. Help us to become his true companions and followers. Ya Allah, prolong the life of and protect all those helping the cause of Islam. All the soldiers that are helping in Iraq against the enemies. Especially the Maraj and especially our beloved leader. Ya Allah, forgive us all of our sins. Forgive our parents, our grandparents, our relatives, all believers, those who are alive, those who have left this world. Ya Allah, we all have hajat, we have needs, we have requests. There are ill maybe in our families, amongst our friends, believers in this community, believers worldwide. We ask you by the right and the truth of Imam Zainul Abidin that you grant all of them and all of us our needs, our requests, our hajat. Cure all the ill in this community, those sitting in this majlis. Ya Allah, our believers, our brothers throughout the globe, in different parts of the world, are suffering from hardships, difficulties, especially now in Iraq, but also in Syria and Palestine and Bahrain and elsewhere. Ya Allah, we ask you, by the right and the truth of Imam Zainul Abidin, that you rid the believers from the hardships, from the enemies, from the cruelties they're facing, inshaAllah. Ya Allah, we ask you by the right of the Imam of our time, that you relieve all the people of the world of the oppressions they're facing. Min Nabi wa Ali, Rahimallah, man qara al-Fatiha ma'as-salawat. Amen.